This is Scenic Roots, talking writing. Our guest again this week is poet, naturalist, and essayist Ray Zimmerman. Last week we talked mostly about Ray's prose writing as a kind of portico to, I don't think you can really separate the two, right? Your poetry and your prose. Comes from the same...
Publishers tend to separate them.
but in terms of the impetus to write, yeah. Do you often sit down consciously to write a poem or to write an essay?
Quite often not. The one dividing point, I do some freelance journalism, and when I sit down to write that, I know it's going to be an article for a publication or a web page, because that's a completely different form of writing. I don't always know if a piece is going to be a poem or a short story.
Does it have anything to do with what you want to talk about?
No, it just has to do with what various rabbit holes my brain finds to go down.
Well, why don't we start with a poem? And would you care to talk about
the
inspiration for it?
Yeah. You know, Ron Rash, famous Southern author, once said in a talk that I attended that he didn't know when he started to write if the piece was going to be a poem, an essay, or a novel. I imagine he figured out pretty quickly if it was a novel.
You would think, wouldn't you?
Yeah, because he didn't stop writing, I guess. But, yeah, it's interesting that those genres, they don't... There is a little bit of flux between them because, you know, we have prose poems, which are just up against the line between prose and poetry, and right on the other side is the lyric essay. Mm-hmm. So it's not a fluid boundary, but there are works that go right up to the boundary.
Well, you know, as we were saying last week, I think your prose is informed by the fact that you think like a poet and write like one.
I suppose so. How about a performance poem? It's kind of been my signature piece for years. Sign. This message brought to you by the Tennessee Valley Authority, by business, industry, and government, by progress, prosperity, and jobs. Mercury. It's an element. It's a metal. It's a liquid. It's toxic. Mercury, it's a capsule launched into space to splash down in the Pacific Ocean. Alan Shepard rode the first Mercury capsule into space, splashed down in the pages of history books. Tennessee River waters contain mercury, not the space capsule, but the element. It's a metal, it's a liquid, it's toxic. Tennessee River fish contain mercury, not the space capsule, but the element. It's a metal. It's a liquid. It's toxic. Pregnant women should not eat these fish. Nursing mothers should not eat these fish. Children should not eat these fish. Adult males may eat these fish. Women past childbearing age may eat these fish. Elderly people are encouraged to eat these fish. Homeless people are required to eat these fish. That is all. Have a nice day.
Did you grow up in Tennessee?
No. Canton, Ohio. Which is interesting. It's just south of Canton, Ohio. And then later we moved into the southern part of the state, Wilmington, Ohio. But Canton, Ohio is very industrial. Very industrial city, as Chattanooga was at one time. And I should say Canton was an industrial city. It's part of what's called the Rust Belt now. Mm-hmm. But everybody I knew, you know, their dad worked at U.S. Steel or Republic Steel or Timken Roller Bearing. You know, those are very industrial sounding company names. Well, they are industry. And then there was, within a mile of our house, there was a small unreclaimed strip mine. And within 5 miles, there was an oil refinery. So it's outside of the part of Ohio that's considered Appalachian, but just barely, I would say. Southeastern Ohio is more like West Virginia and Kentucky than like, say, Indiana, Illinois, or the other lake states.
Less Midwestern.
Those are sort of Midwestern. I call that region the lake states. Southern Illinois has got a lot of coal mining also, so it's got some.
What were your feelings about that when you were growing up?
Well, you know, the coal mine, I didn't see coal mining taking place there. I was shocked when I saw one in operation, you know, this big shovel scraping the earth away and pulling out the coal. The unreclaimed strip mine that we lived near was interesting, though, because blackberries were intruding on the bare land, and so we went up there to pick blackberries, went there to look for snakes when we were kids, and caught a few of them, which our mothers told us to take back when we got home. it was kind of a fascinating place. The oil refinery was less appealing to me because, you know, you could tell you were getting close by the aroma, and there was a big fire on the top of the tower, the cracking tower, they're called, where effluents were being burned off.
Seems like it would be intimidating to kids, that kind of thing.
My father once called it the Statue of Liberty because of the flame. when we started calling it that, he said, that's not good. Don't call it that. That's disrespectful to the statue. But
how did you become a naturalist? Was that in reaction to having grown up surrounded by industry?
Well, there was also open space. There was woods behind us and a wheat field across from us. Not a wheat field, a hay field that they baled the hay. There was a working farm across from us. So that was an influence. My father hunted regularly, so we ate game for dinner. We went fishing. He taught me to fish. We did some camping. So that probably was an influence. And then there's the reaction to the industrial and extractive industry around us. I later learned that a couple of my cousins were made really sick because they lived closer to the oil refinery than we did. And I think their families actually moved elsewhere to preserve their health.
Have you written much about that period of your life?
Not much.
When did you start writing?
Started writing, well, I've kept a journal most of my life, and I've written some journalistic pieces to try to publish in magazines, newspapers, most of my life. Didn't really start poetry until around 1990. So, you know, it's a good 40 years without doing it.
What drew you to it?
Hearing it, meeting other people that wrote poetry. See, I don't think I ever met anyone that was a poet before I moved here to Chattanooga.
When was that?
That was 1990. I came originally to work at what was then called the Chattanooga Nature Center. Now been absorbed into reflection writing. And I was still really focused on journalism, freelance journalism for my writing. But I began to meet poets and essayists and started doing more of that kind of writing and occasional fiction. I think I did write some fiction when I was much younger. It was horrible stuff, though. Not written any.
Well, share with us another of your poems.
I would consider to be of any account until recently. Cranes. Their voices call to my ears, pull my eyes skyward. Heard before sighted, sandhills from Michigan. Cranes overhead, wings southward, call my thoughts to fly with them to Okefenokee or the Gulf Coast of Florida. The cranes arrive, bring their news of winter, their voices compared to barking geese, to the bugling of wild elks. These are no geese, their words no honk, no barnyard bark for them. It is a rattling coo, doves amplified 1,000 times. Arrows shot from a bow, they neither swoop nor slow. They rocket southward, abandon me here, rooted to the ground.
Ray Zimmerman is our guest. So you start out as a journalist, and that's a format all of its own, isn't it? You can't get away with too much poetic expression in journalism.
No, I wouldn't say I was a journalist per se. I did freelance journalism.
What did you tend to write about?
About nature, natural areas. I think the first published piece I had was about the wild horses of Assateague Island. It was called Annual Assateague Pony Roundup, published in a little tabloid-type paper out of Topeka, Kansas, called Cappers. Cappers. They've since been absorbed by another similar paper called The Grit. It's just kind of a... Some people would say a throwaway, but there's, I hate to say that about any writing.
It strikes me, though, that you have in common with journalists that you always tend to write with a point.
Okay. Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah. That's true. The thing I don't have in common with journalists is an ability to meet deadlines. You've got to admire those guys. They're ladies too. They turn around a story and it's ready for publication in time for the next paper. That's a skill I don't have.
I think it's to some degree there's a formula to it, as I guess there is to anything that you have to turn around that quickly.
Yeah,
you know, and that I think is. In common with poetry, perhaps, you know, it's a real discipline. You have to start thinking like that and organize your thoughts that way.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Whereas for you, you're perhaps more an essayist, right? You like to be more reflective than that.
I like to be reflective. The sonnet that I read for last week, that follows a very ironclad formula.
Mm-hmm.
Originated, that was a Petrarchan sonnet. Shakespeare modified it and came up with a new formula, but it's still a formula. And the villanelle.
Or format, anyway.
It's a format, yeah. And the villanelle, the pantoum, the rhyming couplet, which I've done. I've done some rhyming couplets. Those are fun. I don't like to do a lot of them because I think I start to sound like Dr. Seuss. Form poems are fun. They aren't real popular anymore other than haiku. And most haiku written in English aren't really haiku, but we don't want to go into why that's the case. But that's the only form poem that I know that's probably the most popular form worldwide. And I'm not sure why, except that it's short. And it looks easy until you try to do it.
Yeah, what was that? Annie Dillard said she, at one point, she wrote a series of poems taking lines from books.
Mornings said, Like This was the name of the book.
She said, it looks easy, but it was incredibly hard.
Found poems.
It should be the other way around. It should look hard but be easy.
It's hard to fit those together to where you actually mean something. She did a good job, great job with that. I think that was one of only two books of poetry that she published, as far as I know. Her very first book was a book of poems, Tickets to a Prayer Wheel. But I think once she published her second book, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, and it got a Pulitzer Prize, her future was kind of set in concrete.
Where do you go from there, right?
Yeah, she definitely established herself as a prose author. And very good ones.
So you like haiku, you enjoy reading it.
I write a few.
Writing it.
Yeah.
Talk about something that looks easy but is hard. That in some ways is the definitive. It looks on the page so simple.
Mm-hmm.
But in that simplicity is such an enormous challenge.
The rules are multitude. I need to reread the book by Stephen Addis where he talks about there's got to be a word identifying the season, which could be frog if it's a springtime poem. Could be snow if it's a winter poem. Wild geese, I think, for fall, maybe spring, I'm not sure. Azaleas for spring. And you should only use each of those words so many times in your writing. I guess you give up after you've exhausted all those possibilities.
So at one and the same time, it's literal and metaphoric, just to add to the challenge.
Yeah.
On Scenic Roots, this is Talking Writing. Our guest is poet, naturalist, and essayist, Ray Zimmerman.
Clock.
If we have time, I'd like to do one short poem.
Please do.
You ask about from my childhood era. This one is one of my most requested poems. It's called Christmas Papers. I was older when I noticed the same color and pattern on the Christmas paper. Each year, a pattern graced a smaller package. Christmas morning emanated excitement in opening packages with scissors, carefully cutting tape as so as not to rip the paper. I was older when I noticed my mother's hands ironing on Christmas night. She ironed the same towel again and again. Under the towel, Christmas papers lost their creases, regained smooth surfaces. Her hands rolled the paper we could never replace. Choosing between gifts and new paper, she chose gifts. And I guess that gets requests because every time I read it, almost invariably, someone would say, will say, I remember my grandmother doing that. Or there will occasionally be someone in the audience that says, I still do that. There are still people out there who save the Christmas paper and reuse it next year. That's got to be a testament to thriftiness. And I'm all in favor of thriftiness.
You are, huh?
Yes. Our society seems to produce so much disposable stuff. It's just crapola, most of it. Pardon me, I don't know if I can say that word on the radio or not, but most of it is unnecessary.
Well, it certainly runs completely against your philosophy, as I would assume, as a naturalist, as somebody who cares about the natural world.
Yeah, I try to buy all my clothes in thrift stores. Because so much of it gets thrown away or disposed, you know. Thrift stores, I've heard, get so much donated that they actually give them to other charitable organizations who bail them up and send them overseas, often back to the countries where they were made, but the people who live there can't afford to buy them. So it's called a circular economy.
And somebody was saying that the demand in those often third world countries is apparently declining. They're not as interested as they were at one time in used American clothing.
Yeah, well, maybe they can afford to buy new stuff now.
Maybe they want to wear clothes that reflect their own culture more rather than something that says New York Yankees or something.
You know? Yeah, that's probably a good point. Mm. Probably a good point.
What do you do as a vice president of the Chattanooga Writers Guild? What are your responsibilities under that title?
That's an interesting job because it has no defined job responsibility other than to take the president's place if needed. I, though, edit the newsletter.
How often do you publish it?
It's semi-monthly, twice a month. So I think, you know, that I like that because it's sort of like journalism. It's more like journalism than like creative writing.
Mm.
And it keeps the members informed. It has a pretty high open rate compared to, at least so the online service we use to distribute it says, that the open rate and click rate is good, which should make sense because the people actually sign up to receive.
Well, you were talking last week about, you know, the necessity to be working online and how that's in some ways proved to be a real boon for you.
Yeah.
You're meeting writers from, and that kind of, it makes me wonder whether the Guild is going to respond to that potential expansion that the net offers you, that you'll invite people to become members of the Guild who don't necessarily live in Chattanooga.
Yeah, well, we've always had a few outliers who join because they want to participate in our contest, possibly be published in our annual anthology. I would say that if the Guild is going to survive, they're going to have to capitalize on that and start pulling more people in to their events. There's diminishing returns, I suppose, at some point because, you know, you can only fit so many readers into an open mic online. I know there's one local one, not by the Guild. Oh, I think Christian Collier does one. And I think he limits it to just 16 participants, which is a good number. The one out of Nashville that I participate in cuts off sign-in at 25 people, but they give out the link and more show up. And they just add them in. So 4 minutes to a person, possibly 30, 35 people reading in one night. That's more than 2 hours.
Yeah.
And I watched one out of the UK. It's from Scotland. A Scot was the MC, and he announced an intermission an hour and 45 minutes in. And I didn't come back after the intermission.
Satiated your appetite.
He went, at least 3.5 hours. That's. I get Zoom fatigue after that.
But there's also, of course, so many people make podcasts now.
Yeah. And a lot of people do that informally, where they use the go live option on Instagram or Facebook. I've done some of that. I don't announce them in advance, though. I like to just start and see who shows up.
So it seems to me that the beauty of it is, although you may not be in any given time speaking to a lot of people, you can go on as often as you care to. And each time you're more than likely going to reach people you didn't reach the previous time. Whereas when it's contained locally, I think probably tends to be the same people in the audience a lot.
Yeah, it depends on how broad your base of acquaintances in the online platform is.
And the reputation that you develop.
Yeah. The other thing is that it does preserve it. So you can repost it in, mm-hmm. in groups or pages and so forth, up to the point where, you know, you don't fatigue the audience and they say, oh, it's him again. you don't want to quite get to that point.
I don't think you need to be concerned about that based on our conversation and what you've read so far. We have enough time for you to share one more if you care to.
Okay, let me... Reincarnation. An old black vulture landed in a tree overlooking South Chickamauga Creek, gave me a sidelong glance. I thought of Edward Abbey, critic of government agencies, professor and park ranger. Abbey is buried in an illegal grave. A cairn of stones covers his remains. His friends saw to his request, wrote on one stone, Edward Abbey, no comment. The nemesis of Glen Canyon Dam desired no memorial. Got one anyway. He always said he'd come back as a vulture next time. Just seemed fitting. I looked up into the oak, said, hey there, Ed. Looks like a good day for flying. Abby didn't say a word. Just gave me that sidelong glance. The old buzzard.
Thank you, Ray. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
You're always welcome.
I enjoyed reading.
Our guest, poet, naturalist, and essayist Ray Zimmerman's most recent writing and photography is collected on his website, rayzimmermanauthor.com. On Scenic Roots, this is Talking Writing on listener-supported public radio.